You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
I'm Tony Heath.
And this is the Watchathon of Wrestle-On.
It's a podcast you're listening to with your ears.
And maybe your feet.
No.
Okay.
Well, I mean, if you're a particular type of frog, I think you might listen with your feet.
Frogs do that?
I think so. I think I heard that somewhere. I don't know if it's frog. It might be something else, something other than a frog. But I know there's some animal that listens with its feet.
See? And they're a huge fan of this podcast.
All right.
I'm going to have to look up if it's frogs, because I'm not sure.
We'll get back to us on that. For now, here's your theme song. Today, we're going to be talking about the 9th and 10th episodes of the first series of Doctor Who, The Empty Child and the Doctor Dances, which aired from May 21st, 2005 to May 28th, 2005.
True facts!
Joining us today, we have two returning guests, one of which has already done New Who with us, Vincent E.L. Hey, Vince.
Hi. Apparently, elephants can hear with their feet, and they're not the only ones.
Oh.
And they got big ears, so yeah. It's like, why do you... But it's apparently... Maybe they're checking for stampedes and stuff.
I don't know.
Because of stampedes or something. I don't know. To hear if something's coming through the ground.
Is it like
this
yeah.
This is going to drive me crazy.
It's like vibrations. It's like...
Because it's probably easier than putting their ears to the ground, given their anatomy.
But they're so big, they could just droop them down there, probably.
Is that hearing, though, or is that feeling? Vibrations?
Isn't hearing just feeling vibrations?
I don't think I can get into this.
I mean, that's literally what hearing is. I mean, it's how you perceive it, though. It's how your brain interprets the vibrations, but...
Anyway, how you doing, Vince?
Doing okay, I think.
Cool.
I'm a little distracted because I'm trying to find out what else is hears with its feet, but I can't read while people are talking, so forget about it.
I mean, if that's it, I can also feel vibrations with my feet.
Yeah, but can you hear with your feet?
I don't know. I'm asking what the distinction is.
You can interpret the vibrations as stuff, as information.
This is making me dizzy. We should talk about Doctor Who.
Well, we should introduce our other guest first. We'll just never introduce him, and then he just sits there quietly through the whole recording.
Scorpions, kangaroo rats, golden moles.
Do scorpions have feet?
Do scorpions have feet?
Yeah,
I mean,
so
they have legs. I don't know. It depends how you define feet, I suppose. They don't have toes.
You're trying to define hearing, you're trying to define feet. I'm going to introduce our other guest
All
now.
Right.
Adam Clegg has joined us today. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you. It's good to be here. I was just thinking about how the real mummy we found was the friends we made along the way. I also don't really care about which animals can hear through their feet, so I don't have a lot to contribute to that part of the podcast. Sorry.
I don't really care either. Just everybody else here has, like, weird feet fetish. Anyway, you've been on the
podcast. I don't have a feet fetish. Speak for yourself.
But you've been on the podcast before for our Classic Who stuff, but this is your first New Who episode. There's the potential that people don't know who you are, so tell people who you are.
I'm Adam. I co-host two Doctor Who podcasts. There's The Real McCoy, in which we're looking back at the 7th Doctor era, and there's Harry Sullivan is an Imbecile, which is a bit more footloose and fancy free. Neither
where,
of which
where
come
you
out
talk
of...
about the Disney film Footloose and Fancy Free. Wait.
Yeah. I don't know
or
why
were
we
you
call
talking
it
about
Harry
the
Sullivan.
Film Footloose.
Again, I don't care about feet. So yeah, and neither of which come out on a regular schedule, but are still coming out. And yeah.
Tell us how much Doctor Who you've consumed as well.
I have consumed every available piece of televised Who except for the Time Monster Part 6 because it was so bad I stopped watching after Part 5 and I've watched The Twin Dilemma.
Oh, I have a shirt that's based on the Time Monster, so this upsets me greatly.
Which one?
Baby Benton.
Oh, Baby Benton.
I have a Baby Benton shirt. If you haven't seen the last episode...
That because that was great.
Yeah, if you missed the last episode, then you missed the bit where there's just a full-on grown adult naked Benton.
John Levine naked. There's an interesting thought. The Series 9 box set has come out, so when that comes out in standard edition, I will watch it because I can't put off the inevitable forever, like death.
All right. And I think you'll have like a reappraisal and be like, oh, this is actually great.
Actually, this one's my favorite of all time.
Could be.
So before we dive into this episode, before we started recording,
we all just watched a thing.
Trailer dropped.
Trailer dropped for the 60th anniversary specials. What do we think?
I missed them. Those are my friends, and I missed them.
It's nice to be excited about Doctor Who again.
It's nice to have a marketing push where the people involved actually want people to see it and know it's happening. And yeah, it's nice not to give away how I feel about the Chibnall era too much, but it's nice to look forward to Doctor Who without the sense of anxiety and dread. I'm actually really, really excited for the 60th and for what comes after as well. Yeah, the trailer was good. I've only watched it once, about 3 minutes before this, so we can't say a lot. It's a lot of old footage and a bit of new, but still not giving away too much of the plot. But I think we can all agree that Neil Patrick Harris is definitely playing the Valiard.
1,000%. What?
I think he's the Ronnie.
I think he's the monk.
Somebody eventually is going to have to be the Valiard, right?
It's never the Ronnie. It's never the Valiard.
It's got to be right one time. If we just keep saying it, one of these days we have to be right.
What if it's just Neil Patrick Harris?
I like that.
What if he's secretly the Macra?
There's no such thing as Macra.
The Macra do not exist.
Well, that's what he wants you to think.
There is a bit in the trailer that I wonder if you enjoyed, where there's a gigantic, huge Neil Patrick Harris, and he's doing like some like puppeteering stuff, marionette.
Yeah, man. That shit was great.
I like the idea it might actually be Neil Patrick Harris, or the Doctor's like, I know you. I've seen How I Met Your Mother.
And I've still not forgiven you. That's the conflict.
Also, it's like interesting because we're currently watching this season of Doctor Who. Seeing that same sort of all those people from this kind of era of Doctor Who, but the visuals, like the camera looks so much better. It's way more high definition.
I was going to say, no one's got that soft standard definition sheen about them. It's quite noticeable.
Everybody like glows a little bit orange, I feel like.
It was very weird to be watching that trailer and be like, that's Crowley.
Yeah, Tony is currently obsessed with Good Omens.
I've just been rewatching Good Omens.
And I have not watched season 2 yet, but I remember Crowley in season 1, and I still maintain that David Tennant was channeling Bill Nighy.
I can see that. We also watched all of Staged as well, which is also really good. We're currently in a David Tennant phase, and now...
I guess, yeah. We're
about to get into new Tennant stuff and old Tennant stuff.
It's weird.
That is weird. But right now we're in Christopher Eccleston, so let's talk about
it. Let's do it.
Let's talk Eccleston.
I have written a summary of this two-parter. I will read the summary, and then we'll just discuss whatever we want to talk about. I have both come up with a serial title for this two-parter and alternate titles for the two episodes, which I will reveal as I read my summary. What I've called the serial is Mummy, That's What I Want.
Why are you like this?
He wants his mummy. I don't... Okay. The first episode I have called A Pair of Jacks, because there's Captain Jack and she's wearing the Union Jack.
Okay.
In A Pair of Jacks, the Doctor and Rose chase down a vessel hurtling through time and wind up in World War II era London.
That it was mauve.
This is a summary. I'm not going to mention every single thing.
All right.
They wind up in World War II era London. Rose wanders off after seeing a boy in a gas mask named Jamie, we'll learn later, and winds up dangling from a rope attached to a barrage balloon. Rose is rescued by a former time agent named Captain Jack Harkness. They flirt a lot on his invisible spaceship, and he uses Nana Jeans to fix her hands. Jack also wants to sell her the vessel they were chasing. Meanwhile, the Doctor has stumbled across a group of homeless children who are stealing food while people hide out in their bomb shelters. Soon, the Doctor learns that the leader of the children, Nancy, lost her brother. She shows him where the vessel landed, but also tells him to talk to a Dr. Constantine first. He does so and finds a whole ward full of barely alive patients with gas masks fused to their faces.
That's Constantine.
Constantine. I prefer the Keanu Reeves pronunciation. Dr. Constantine grows a mask as well. Jack and Rose show up, and Jack reveals that he was attempting to con them by selling them a useless ambulance that would be...
Attempting a condom? What?
Attempting to con them by selling them a useless ambulance that would be blown up by a bomb before they could find out it wasn't a warship. Then all the gas mask people surround them, repeating, "Are you my mummy?" That's the end of episode one. In episode two, which I have called The Dr. Fox...
Hey, that was my title for it as well.
It's what it means.
That's what it means.
Dancing is a metaphor for fucking flank steak. The doctor,
I understood
Rose,
that reference.
Lonely Island. The doctor sends everyone to their room, and it works. The doctor, Rose, and Jack investigate and wind up in the room he sent all the gas mask people to and are confronted by Jamie. Jack tries to shoot him, but the doctor swapped his blaster for a banana. They run, and Jack eventually teleports out. He works on also teleporting the doctor and Rose while they get a little busy dancing. Meanwhile, Nancy gets arrested and left with a transforming guard. She is freed by the doctor, and they all go to the crash site. The doctor realizes that the medical transport was full of nanogenes that tried to fix Jamie, but didn't know humans, so it fused the gas mask to his face, then used that as a template to fix everyone else. As they are surrounded by gas mask zombies, the doctor realizes that Nancy is actually Jamie's mother and not his sister. Jamie asks, "Are you my mummy?" Nancy says yes. They hug, and the nanogenes read Nancy's DNA and use the updated info to correctly fix everyone up, with the exception of giving someone a leg they didn't previously have. Everybody lives! Also, Jack stops the bomb with his tractor beam, then the doctor saves Jack from exploding with the bomb, and they all fuck in the TARDIS. And that is my summary.
Yeah, that's 100% how it ends, yeah?
I feel like this is my longest summary yet, because this is the most complex plot we've had in Doctor Who so far. In New Who, anyway.
That's very much a Stephen Moffat thing, of the complex plot showing off. I would describe it as showing off. Flexing is really what he's doing. He's flexing, he's writing craft.
And I enjoy that.
Yeah, I enjoy it. It does, at a point later on, become a little repetitive. A little bit. Especially because he ultimately does the same thing a number of times, which is cheat death. Like he sets up a bunch of plot devices that are intricately tied together into like a plot machine. And then he uses that machine to cheat death because he introduces a certain death element of here's a character who is dead or is definitely going to be dead at the end of the story. And then he uses the plot machine that he's built to make that death not have happened or something else happened that seemed like death, but it wasn't. Or they died, but then they undied or something. That's the thing he does a lot.
I actually don't really agree with that. I think it gives the impression of that, and I know it's a cliche of like, oh yeah, he brings everyone back. But I think if you actually look at it, like, say, take Clara, obviously, is one. This has nothing to do with the Dr. Dance's empty child. Sorry, I've just realised I was about to do my... This is an incorrect interpretation of Moffat rant that I do sometimes, but I'm going to go for it. You know, Clara is always going to die in that alleyway. What the Moore does is he finds Ray's to... You're right, cheat. For a while, but I think death is always inevitable. He just finds ways around it.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying, is he finds some kind of cheat so that he doesn't have to fucking deal with it.
But then it happens. It always happens. Like, even when River comes back in Name of the Doctor, which is the only time we see a post-library River, and it's really interesting, and I think maybe people don't, because there's so much going on in that episode it doesn't get picked up on, but she talks about being a digital ghost that should have faded away, and I always find that really interesting, because it kind of suggests she's not really River. She's a memory of River. Do you know, like, River is dead, but what the Doctor does is save her memory. And even then, it's suggested that maybe she's not going to be around forever. But none of this is relevant to this story, sorry. I think the best thing about this story is obviously that it introduces a very important character into Doctor Who, and that is Richard Wilson as Dr. Constantine, who's by far my favourite guest actor in this story.
Yeah, he's very good.
Oh, for sure.
Were you familiar with Richard Wilson before Doctor Who? Because he's well known in this country for a sitcom he did, One Foot in the Grave. It's like during the 90s.
I didn't know that.
Not from that, but from Merlin.
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah, he's in Merlin as well. But I think up to, by the time his Doctor Who appearance came, it was, if you'd ask most people, it would be One Foot in the Grave, which was, I think, had finished a few years before.
I had not heard of that show, so.
I have not seen that show.
We watched all of Merlin, but that was after I'd watched Doctor Who. But I think I knew him from something else.
I recognize him from something, but it might just be from this. I don't know.
I will say, Merlin is frustratingly bad. Worst ending to a show I have ever seen.
Does it include How I Met Your Mother? Oh, you never watched. I never watched the end of How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah, so haha.
You're better off probably.
I've seen How to Get Ahead in Advertising, but again, that was post Doctor Who. Probably the thing I knew him from before Doctor Who was The Man Who Knew Too Little, the Bill Murray film. So
I have not seen that.
Oh, it's fun. Bill Murray's brother buys him this like experience, this like acting thing, sort of role playing in London thing. But then something gets crisscrossed and he winds up in the middle of an actual spy plot. But he thinks it's all just like for fun. And he like winds up like, you know, taking out evil bad guys and stuff. But he doesn't realize it's all real. He thinks it's fake. And I enjoy that kind of comedy. But yeah, I think that's all I'd seen him in before Doctor Who was The Man Who Knew Too Little.
I didn't realize there was a film in Richard Wilson and Bill Murray were in together. So that's actually, this has been an educational experience for me.
I've seen a movie called The Shark Who Knew Too Much. which is a Swedish movie from 1989.
People haven't seen The Man Who Knew Too Little? I thought it was fairly popular. I don't know. It's got Bill Murray.
I'm familiar with the title. I know Bill Murray's in it, but I haven't seen it.
It's got Peter Gallagher, Alfred Molina, Richard Wilson.
Love.
Yeah.
You can't go down this divergent.
I know. We haven't talked about this two-parter at all.
Yeah, but Moff alert.
That's like the first joke in the episode, and it's very Moffat. It immediately goes full on Moffat.
The thing is, it seems to establish a fact that is going to be a fact for the rest of the universe. I don't recall it ever coming up again.
Nah.
But it really should have, because that would have been a cool like running gag to have like Moff alert be like a running thing throughout New Who.
What color is Moff? I don't even really know.
Purple?
Purple? Okay.
Yeah.
I could be down for that. They should bring it back.
So, to talk about the episode, it's odd seeing Captain Jack now because there's a lot of history with him and, let's be honest, John Barrowman that isn't all positive. I think this is one of his best, Captain Jack's best Doctor Who appearances. I think the kind of like the charming con man thing always works a little better for me than Leader of Torchwood ever did.
I was thinking about that today. We watched this and I was like, I forgot that he was like a con man and all this stuff. And I wonder, because like Torchwood was written a lot by Chris Chibnall. Did Chris Chibnall just make Jack a cop?
Sanitize.
Did he just make him a cop? Is that what Chibnall does? It's just make characters cops?
Does Chibnall take characters with anarchic energy and turn them into cops? If only there was some other example.
It is a pity that this is the only episode that Stephen Moffat wrote with Jack.
What's so funny about this, when we were watching the episode, is there's like, it is like a reveal the first time he turns around, and it made me laugh, because it was like, oh, it's Jack!
But that
was his first episode, so it's almost like it was filmed that way for second viewings.
Well, at one point, I think you're meant as a viewer to think for like 3 seconds that Jack is the Doctor from like the past or the future, specifically when Nancy says something about the Doctor, and then it cuts to Rose and Jack.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
That's, I think, the moment when the audience is meant to think, wait, is Jack actually the Doctor doing a thing? Either the Doctor from the future, like, playing with Rose and, like, giving her the thing that she wants, or the Doctor from the past showing Rose what the Doctor used to be. I think that's what the audience is meant to, like, take from that moment for like a couple of seconds and then remember, oh wait, he doesn't know this and he doesn't know that and it doesn't make any sense. But like, I think for that moment, I think that's the angle that it's supposed to. I vaguely remember thinking that the first time I saw it, because I didn't know that much about Doctor Who first time around. So I was like, could it be the Doctor? And then no.
I mean, he is definitely played as like sort of a metaphor for the Doctor. He's like a contrast. He's like the Doctor who fucks. This episode is a lot about sex. A lot about sex. Which I didn't fully realize, and then I read a review by
the Tartar Sanatorium.
Yeah. And I was like, oh wow, yeah, this episode is all about sex.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, when I first watched this, and I would have been like 23 when I first watched this, I didn't pick up on dancing being a metaphor, which I'm quite embarrassed by, because once you realize it is, you're like, oh, yeah.
Like, that's barely subtext, but honestly, same boat.
But I think I've read the same review you have, and I think El Sandifer makes a really nice point that it's very good that it ends with, like, Nancy accepting her, you know, her sexual past and her what would have been considered indiscretion, and it's that acceptance and love that saves everything. It's, you know, there's nothing that she's done to be ashamed of, even if she feels shame. Because, you know, it's the kind of thing that could go horribly wrong in another writer's hand, but here it's like, no.
Yeah, the enemy in this episode is shame.
That was originally, in the original draft, was going to be even, there was going to be even more shame. Because, like, yeah, the twist at the end is that Nancy, who's, like, very young, is actually Jamie's mother, not her sister. So she'd have been, like, 15 or something when she had him. But there was going to be a character who was a German, like, soldier or whatever, that was, like, kind of hanging out around her a lot and was mute. But there was going to be the dad. The dad was a German, so... and then they cut that. But, like, that would have added, like, an extra, like, not only was she, like, an underage mom, but she also, it was, like, this German guy was the dad, so. But they cut that out.
That's probably fine.
Nancy kind of, I guess, pays forward the shaming as well when she confronts the guy who's been sleeping with the butcher.
Mm. Yeah.
Because, like, she straight up shames him for that.
Blackmails him, really.
Yeah, he's cheating on his partner, obviously. That's not good. But still, that's playing into the theme of the story.
And not to mention all the dancing talk. There's that whole thing with the doctor talking about Jack, basically, everyone in the future going out to the world to dance. But basically meaning fucking. And then there's all this stuff about the doctor, and there's the doctor and Jack.
Whether or not the doctor fucks.
Yeah. The doctor dances with Rose. Rose dances with Jack. It's a whole thing. There's a whole thing at the end about, like, the doctor potentially dancing with Jack. That's a big old poly situation.
Totally ended on, like, anyway, this is our new OT3. Thanks. Thanks for coming to our TED Talk.
I think there is a personal message to fandom when, you know, Rose says the world doesn't end if the doctor dances. Because this is the same fandom that at one point went, I know he keeps saying Susan is his granddaughter, but what if she was something completely different and convoluted? And then he comes on and goes, nah, look, she's his granddaughter. It's not just, it's not just Moffat who does that. Obviously, people tend to think, oh yeah, Moffat introduced sex into Doctor Who. No, there's sex in the classic series. It's maybe a bit more subtext. But also, you know, RTD is famously not a writer who is ashamed of sex or doesn't write about sex. Moffat maybe makes it more central in this story, but, you know, it's there beforehand. Like,
the whole grandfather thing comes up as well with the doctor, and the doctor having the conversation. And the doctor says to the doctor, I was a father and a grandfather, blah, blah, blah. And the doctor is like, yeah, I can relate or whatever. I don't remember the exact dialogue, but that was an exchange, and that's also thematic.
This is, like, the first episode this season where everything's
very intentional.
Yeah, it's so structured
and
purposeful in a way that nothing before it really was.
Listen, RTD's about vibes, okay?
This was the episode the two-parter, I guess, that sold me on Doctor Who. I was enjoying it before, but this is the one where, like, okay, this show is great. Also, speaking of sex, there's also a whole scene where the doctor and Jack are basically just comparing dick sizes, but through sonic metaphor. And on the Doctor Who Confidential, Stephen Moffat straight up says everything about that scene is about sex. Everything. So it's on purpose. It's not something we're reading into it. It's on purpose.
We know Barrowman liked to show his sonic blaster to lots of people.
Oof.
It is weird. And that, like, this has always been a character that I've really enjoyed. And it's one of those things where it's like, well, I'm just going to enjoy this fiction and not think about anything else. Like,
I've been having to do the same thing with Mickey. So this whole era is full of bad people. but good things. This episode is very good. So good it won a Hugo.
Nice.
It was up against other Doctor Who's, I think. Really? So, yeah.
So, I mean, that's an easy win. What was it up against?
I think it was up against Father's Day and...
Oh, okay.
Dalek?
Might have been Dalek.
I don't know. That's just a guess on my part, because I think it's an episode of some note.
Good one. Not the only other good one in the season, but the only one that you'd be like...
Isn't it weird that the best episodes of this season are not written by RTD? It was up against Battlestar Galactica Pegasus. I don't know that episode. I was up against Dalek, Father's Day, Jack Attack, The Incredibles short.
Wait, Battlestar Galactica was on at this point?
Must have been.
I thought it came later.
No, I think it started about I want to say 2003, because people used to think that a Doctor Who reboot should be like Battlestar Galactica, which is, or like the rebooted Battlestar Galactica, which is hilarious in retrospect. But it was interesting watching this, actually, because I think that sometimes there's a bit of a tendency to think of Eccleston as being like a kind of grim, dark Doctor. And watching this, I was like, no, he's so goofy.
He's so goofy.
Like, I love him so much. He's one of my favourites. And, you know, it's one of the only things I changed about Doctor Who history was I'd give Eccleston another season just to see him grow. Because, you know, every Doctor, I think, is always slightly more interesting in their second off or gets into their rhythm in their second season and really gets to play with the part. But he's so good.
He does so many good faces in this episode.
Opposite of that, by the way. But, like, people remember Tennant as, like, a very goofy Doctor, and it's like, no, this is a broody kind of an ass. Like,
yeah,
I mean, just the way Eccleston says, "Rose, I'm trying to resonate concrete." I don't know, but it's just so good. And obviously, the end of just give me more days like this, just this once.
Oh my god,
everybody lives, which is so good. Partly because he is the Time War Doctor, but also if you've grown up watching Doctor Who or are familiar with it at this point, as I was when I first watched it. It's a show with such a high body count, and even like, you know, Rose ends with like a massacre. Poor Clive gunned down with his whole family, presumably. There's such a power in that moment. When he's just like, he gets to win.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a profound joy.
There are so many scenes in this two-parter of just the Doctor doing stuff with his face that's really good. Like when he first arrives and he gets up on stage and asks us if anything's crashed here lately. Everyone thinks he's doing like a stand-up bit or whatever. But at the very end, when he realizes where he is, he sees the Hitler poster. He sees the Hitler poster and he says, "Bomb." And then does this like, face. It's so good. When Nancy tells him that he needs to go see the doctor and he's like, "What?" And he does this again, this like incredulous face. He just keeps doing these really funny faces. And I feel like, yeah, he doesn't get enough cred for being funny, because he can be funny.
Yeah.
I'm looking at my notes here. Did you know Jack was originally going to be called Jax, J-A-X?
Really?
And be an alien?
I have a friend named Jax.
Oh.
Yeah. Somebody I went to college with.
I just realized.
Are they an alien?
You know, they could be. No, they're just trans.
This also introduces my favorite subplot that is never resolved, of Jack being like, "I lost 2 years of my memory."
Right!
It's never... I don't think Big Finish have ever... Well, maybe Big Finish have. They've got so much stuff. But, you know, Torchwood never tackles it. Doctor Who never tackles it. I think Moffat said it was something RTD asked him to put into the script. Like, so maybe RTD had some idea of what he wanted to do. But it's just like, I don't know if anyone's ever actually dealt with it.
Well, we were sitting there when we were watching it, and Joe looked at me and he was like, "Is that a plot point? Is that something that they talk about in Torchwood?" And I was like, "I have no memory. I don't. Do they?" And we, like, we sat there and, like, tried to work it out. It was like, does that ever come up again?
So I don't remember it ever coming up again. It's good to have confirmation that,
no, we didn't forget. It just didn't happen.
I just realized there's two characters this season named Jack. There's three Jacks now. Union Jack, Captain Jack, and Jackie.
Sure.
Why are there so many Jacks?
As is apparent by all the news we've heard about the new stuff, RTD's only got so many names.
RTD has a thing for the names Jack and Rose.
Right.
And I think it might come back to Titanic.
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't even think of that.
I've thought of it always, like since 2004 or whenever I first started watching.
When did Titanic come out? That was like late 90s, right?
97, 98, something like that. So are we saying that in the 60th anniversary, Tennant's going to regenerate because Donna pushes him off a floating door into the cold ocean?
Well, I mean, the Titanic cliffhanger already happened.
There is an episode on board a Titanic as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, exactly. That's the episode following the episode ending that I'm talking about. I just think that Russell T. Davis is a fan of the movie Titanic. I think he has a thing for it. And I don't know why, because it's a shit movie. And that is not a hot take. That is a cold-ass take, and I stand by it as the cold-ass take that it is. Titanic, shit movie. I don't care what anybody agrees or disagrees with. It is a shit movie.
I agree with you. I don't like it either. I have another note here. The Chula warship, which is, turns out to be an ambulance. Chula is named after a restaurant that all the writers would go to.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to discuss the episodes and stuff.
So is it a bistromatic?
I think it's like an Indian place. So,
well, I mean, the ship. Is it a bistromatic?
No, it's an ambulance full of Nana jeans.
Is this like the last bit of genre fiction where people kept talking about nanobots and nanogenes? I feel like they were very prevalent kind of in the 90s, early 2000s, and now you don't tend to get them turning up in stuff so much anymore.
No, they turn up everywhere. All the fucking Marvel helmets are made of fucking nanobots.
That's true.
The nanotech is all over the MCU, and in the Arrowverse, you had the nanites courtesy of Ray Palmer. That was a kind of a running gag.
Okay, let me rephrase that. In stuff I care about, are they still doing nanobots?
Do you watch Star Trek?
I've seen a bit of Strange New Worlds. I mean, I know my 90s Star Trek.
There's an episode of Strange New World that has a plot point that feels very much inspired by this episode.
Is it in the? I've seen the first season. Is it in the first season?
It's in season two, I think. Okay. I think it's season two. Because what happens, I'm gonna just lightly skim over it to sort of give the premise, because I don't want to spoil it too much. But there's an episode where there are some like beyond human capacity of understanding aliens who have like medical technology beyond human comprehension. They fix Spock and use the template of the person, the other person in the ship, who is a human. And Spock is, of course, half human, so they got like mixed messaging, and they used the human template to fix Spock, so Spock turns human. That's the premise of an episode, and I feel like that's basically the same idea from this episode of like of the nanogenes misreading the information that they have and using the wrong template to fix people according to that false template.
Speaking of Star Trek, two quick notes. One, the nanogenes were originally called nanites, but I think they changed it because nanites was used in Star Trek. Two, there's the ongoing thing about Rose wanting the Doctor to be more Spock. And she tells Jack that the Doctor's name is Spock. And he's like, why did you do that? And she's like, you don't have a name. And she's like, what even is your name? Doctor Who. And he was originally going to say, I'd rather have Doctor Who than Star Trek. But they cut that line. But
it was a little on this. Rose apparently knows one sci-fi reference, because I don't feel like Spock is a very fitting reference. I mean,
if you're talking about Doctors who fuck.
Spock is a sci-fi character who fucks, and it's Kirk.
I'm just saying, there are probably more sexual characters than Spock.
I don't know. I think he fucks Kirk on a regular basis.
Oh, okay. I've never seen Star Trek.
I mean, there's Ponfar.
No, I'm Foo, thank you.
I've literally only seen the cage.
What you have to understand about original Star Trek is, you know, Kirk likes to think he's a ladies' man and everyone's sleeping with him, but I'm fairly certain between episodes, everyone's visiting Dr. McCoy on the quiet.
I think Kirk is a hopeless romantic and he just keeps falling in love. I think that's what happens.
There's literally a moment in Star Trek the Motion Picture where they beam McCoy up, they haven't seen him for years, and he turns up looking like he's just come from the cocaine orgy party and seems a bit into. So yeah, I'm just saying, it's not text, but it is kind of text.
Well, that's why he has the nickname, right?
Bones. Yes,
he's just boning.
But the way that Rose talks about Spock, it makes it sound like Spock is some kind of space James Bond. And it just doesn't fit. So I feel like she's heard of Spock but doesn't really know anything about Star Trek. She's just going, I want this to be more sci-fi. What's the sci-fi character? Spock?
And it's also like a well-known name, so it's not like something uber specific that she probably wouldn't know.
Yeah, she's a bit of a normie.
Yeah, she's got to be a little genre unaware. Why does Rose grab that rope? That's the one thing in this episode that I feel is so stupid. And also, why wouldn't she just let go of it immediately once it's started to move?
I can answer this. Can answer this actually. So, you know how in the episode Rose, she says that she got the bronze and the gymnastics, blah, 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 and she sort of saves the day by swinging from the chain. You know that?
Yeah.
You remember that? Yeah. So the thing is, that's the thing. That's, she's trying to save the day. She's like, oh, last time I was in a situation where something was swingable, I swung, and then it worked out. So here goes. This is going to save the day.
It doesn't. She has to be rescued. That's another thing. This episode is so good at, like, setting stuff up and not making it obvious that it's, like, the nanogenes and the tractor beam. Every little thing is, like, put into the episode beautifully and pays off. And this is the first
nanogenes
episode.
Nanogenes and tractor beams.
Yes. It just, everything comes together so nicely. And that's what I really loved about this episode. Because, like, the stuff before, stuff would just kind of happen. And then just, like, things are happening. And there's no setup. It's all just as it happens, which I think is what RTD specifically likes doing. He wants it to feel very spontaneous. But I so enjoyed, like, Chekhov-ing the hell out of all the guns, you know?
You enjoy seeing the craft of something.
Yeah. And
the structure of it.
I enjoy that the fact that it is handled so well. Like, none of it feels like exposition. And I feel like it's because Moffat, in this episode particularly, is really good at hiding the exposition in, like, scenes where, like, Jack and Rose are just hardcore flirting.
Emotionally grounded scenes.
Yeah, they all happen in scenes where, like, there's other stuff going on, so it doesn't feel like exposition.
I think it seems even more obvious to us now, having bluntly just come off the Chibnall era. Yeah, that's gonna
where
sound
all
harsh.
The exposition comes at the end.
You know, Yaz at the back going, this thing is like this thing on Earth and stuff. And you're just like, oh, please, God. I had a friend who, you know, who's not a Doctor Who fan the way I am, but he liked to watch it. And he sent me a text going, can we get Moffat back to do a bit of a dialogue punch up on this? And I was like, no, that's not going to happen. But yeah, and I think what's interesting is from this is quite, I think I would say this episode is quite an influence on RTD himself going forward. I think after this, because you're right, it's definitely like the tightest, at this stage in the show, it is the most tightly plotted of the new series. And I think RTD ups his game on that. And he has said himself, it was this episode that made him think, oh yeah, Doctor Who can be scary. Or we can make it scary again.
And it's interesting that the guy who brought scary into the show, or back into the show, is the sitcom writer.
Yeah, you know, it is. Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying. And it's, again, it's interesting that with Classic Who, you know, there's this old thing in Britain of you can jokingly go, oh, do you remember the one with the maggots? And what it is, it's like everyone who saw Green Death at a certain age is terrified enough and it becomes iconic in its own way. And this is definitely one of those because, you know, lots of, again, and I'm putting quotation marks around this, normal viewers, Are You My Mummy still has a certain, you say that to certain people, they will know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah,
it's still got that, because to make something Doctor Who iconic, you know, be it, you know, the maggots or say actually the mummies from Pyramid of Mars, to take another classic example, you make it terrifying and kids will remember it 20 years later.
This is such a good episode. I will say there is one maybe tiny bit of bad writing.
The typewriter?
Yeah, the typewriter's one. Apparently that was like a last minute addition because the episode was underrunning. So there's that scene where the thing is talking through the typewriter, which
this is a very minor quibble.
It's a minor quibble, but I was gonna talk about, so our Bad Wolf update.
Oh,
the bomb almost hits the medical transport pod thing. Jack catches it with a tractor beam and he's riding it because, of course, he's got a big bomb between his legs.
Right.
There's like graffiti or whatever on the bomb that says Schlechter Wolf, which literally means bad wolf, but it means bad as in the sense of inadequate instead of like evil or whatever. So
it's a low quality wolf.
Yeah, it's a low quality
it's a subpar wolf.
Janky wolf.
According to Wikipedia, a more proper translation would be Boser Wolf. So
how confident do you feel pronouncing that?
Not at all. B O with the umlauts, S E R. So
Boser Wolf?
Sure. Apparently that's closer than Schlechter Wolf.
Because I know W is pronounced like a V and V is pronounced like F. I believe the O with the umlaut is similar to how it's pronounced in Swedish, so I would think it's probably Buzzwolf.
Well, there you go. That's what it should have said.
This is my guess. I don't speak German. I just hear German occasionally.
That's more than I got. I never hear German.
Is wolf just wolf?
If it's with the W, then it's wolf.
But yeah, is there no like German word for wolf though? Is it?
I believe that is a German word. It's wolf.
Oh. We do that. Oh, English does that. We pilfer words.
Because English is kind of, you know, it's made of like mostly German and Latin, and
it's a hodgepodge of stuff.
Yeah, it's mostly German and Latin. It's both a Germanic language and a Romance language, I think.
So I've gotten through all of my notes. Is there anything else we need to talk about or anything else people want to talk about? that we haven't talked about?
I just think it's funny watching Captain Jack's first scene and knowing his last scene in the program will be a voicemail recording.
I don't even remember his last. It was in Chibnall, so the whole...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was in...
He came back and it was a whole thing.
But then his final goodbye was literally a voicemail recording. And just, I don't know what happened. Something happened.
I fully don't remember this. Tells you how engaged I was.
Yeah, I don't remember what he did in the show at all. It was in, like, what, two episodes, maybe?
Yeah, he turned up in Fugitive of the Jadoon and then Revolution of the Daleks.
He was a glorified plot device.
Okay. I don't remember. Like, I couldn't tell you anything of the plot of large swaths of the Chibnall era.
He was mostly there for, like, vague and useless exposition.
Fugitive of the Jadoon's not bad, but I remember being like, this entire scene with Jack is pointless. I mean, everything in Chibnall is ultimately pointless. He just introduced things and did nothing with them.
He shows up and he's like, beware of the lone Cyberman. And then they're like, what? And then they run into the lone Cyberman and it's like, oh, look, it's the lone Cyberman. Well, what are we supposed to do? Beware, I guess. Very helpful.
Chibnall is like Moffat, like, but like setting stuff up and then forgets about it.
Chibnall's like plot, like I'm with my keys. Where did I put that?
I thought you were going to say another Star Trek reference. He's like the Mirror Universe version, so Moffat with little beard.
I think we'll take an ad break and we'll be back for final thoughts.
Soul Forge Podcast. It's a geeky look at love, life, fandom, mental health, pop culture, and so much more. If you're into learning about yourself and the universe, Soulforge is your podcast. Each week, we have a surprising new topic, from stupid things we do for love to product reviews, and there's almost always a fun guest host. Like and subscribe to Soulforge Podcast today.
And we're back. Tony, do you know what time it is?
Yeah, I do.
What time is it?
Oh, you want me to tell you?
Yes.
What time it is?
That's why I asked.
Okay. It is 2:23 p.m. on a Saturday.
No, it's 8:23 p.m.
Incorrect. I'm in Imperial time. The only true correct time.
What? Imperial time?
Imperial.
You should switch to metric.
Adam's in a completely different time than either of us, so he's caught in a time eddy.
I hate when that happens.
That'll teach me to go punting in Cambridge.
But what do we do at this point in the show?
This bit, every time.
I know.
It's time, the time in the podcast is it's, the time is for this bit.
And then what do we do after that bit? What happens at the end of the bit when you finally relent?
You never relent.
When you finish your bit?
Oh, when I decide that it's been concluded?
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned, this bit can continue for the rest of the show.
When I decide it's been concluded, we do final thoughts.
Yay, has it been concluded?
It's been concluded.
Final thoughts. Final thoughts.
Okay, well, it's a joyous story, really. I think it's one of the best of the Auto Brief Eccleston era. Possibly the one that if, you know, you were trying to show someone his Doctor and his time, this would be the one I'd show them. You know, it's the first time that Modern Who is scary, it's funny, and like you said, it's so beautifully plotted. It's just a triumph. It's one of those episodes you can always watch, and there's always something to it, and it's just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic, as the Ninth Doctor might say. but no, brilliant. Just brilliant.
I really like these episodes. And I may not have made it clear, but I really like Stephen Moffat's writing in general. I think he's a good writer, and I think he's very good at his craft. But he does have hang-ups that over time get a little repetitive. At this point, that is not evident. And I think even after having seen everything that comes after it, watching this episode, it doesn't feel tiresome. It doesn't feel like it's more of the same. It's like, this is, yes, the seed of things that end up becoming repetitive, but even after seeing all the repetitive stuff, seeing this again does not feel like a repetition of everything that came after, if that makes sense. So for me, this totally works. And I think the stuff that comes later works too. It's just, I think after a while, some of the tropes that he keeps coming back to get a little like, okay, we're doing this again. Okay, well, I'm okay. But for some reason, I can watch this and I'm not feeling that. And that's cool. And I say that as someone who likes those later episodes as well, even with acknowledging the repetitiveness of certain tropes. So having said that, I don't know what I was going to say after having said that. I like these episodes. I think that's the main takeaway here. I think they are well plotted, and I think they are thematically coherent and cohesive, and they fit the era as well in a like not directly obvious way. Like when you tell a story in the 50s, the go-to is like, oh, it's going to be a story about paranoia. When you tell a story in the 20s, it's going to be a story about oppression or something. And when you tell a story early 30s? I don't know the timeline exactly.
I think it's late.
When was the Blitz? That was the
40s.
41. 40s. Yeah, I think it was 41 because I remember thinking the whole time that there's an entire Good Omens episode happening.
Yeah, it's 41.
Right, okay. So the thing about like World War II is like there's a lot of stuff going on in World War II. So there's not like one central obvious theme for all stories set in the era or in that period of time. And I think grabbing on to shame as like a central theme is an interesting angle to take because so much of the Second World War was about shame, was about a society that decided to shame people for being different, basically, and had a very narrow view of what you're supposed to be. And everyone who's not what you're supposed to be is the bad. So it's interesting to take that and then turn it into this, which is not like the obvious way of taking that either. It's not like this is an episode about Jews. Like, it's not really about like any like specific group. And it's not about like one group oppressing another group. It's just the idea of shame and how it kind of festers in people. And in a way that is very not obvious and yet like fits the setting and the period. It's interesting. Like, it's one of those things where like watching this episode or these episodes, I don't know what idea came first. And that's an interesting place to be in as a viewer who tends to view things from an angle of what is the writer trying to do here. And when I'm seeing this, I don't know what the first thought was. I don't know what Stephen Moffat went, okay, I'm going to write a story about this, or I'm going to write a story with this concept in it. Or like, I don't know if it started with one of the plot devices or if it started with the theme, or I don't know. I can't tell. And I think that's a good thing. When you have a story that it's not clear what idea came first, and yet all of the ideas in it, even though there are many ideas in it, fit together so well.
All the parts are working to support each other, and it's you can't look at it and say, ah, this is all built around this central thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if it started with the nanites. I don't know if it started with the idea of the, are you my mummy? And then everything else is an excuse for that. Or if it started with the, I'm going to write a story about shame in the 1940s. Like, I don't know where it started. And I that's interesting to me because everything feels like it's, everything supports everything. And it's not like everything is supporting one thing, but everything together is one thing. It's a cool machine he built.
I think that's why this is the episodes that sold me on the show, is because it's doing so many things. It's doing them all at once, and it's doing them all great. Because like, I feel like there'd been funny episodes before, there'd been emotional episodes before, there'd been episodes that did things, but this one did all of them all at once and did it well and mixed it. And cause it's terrifying. Mm. It's super scary, but everybody lives.
Right, yeah.
It's ultimately hopeful and joyful. It's very funny. It's romantic, even. There's just every genre possible in this. There's war, there's love, there's everything. It's doing everything all at once, and it's doing it just mwah, beautifully.
It's as if Stephen Moffat thought it was the only episode he would write of the show, and so he did all of the things.
Yeah.
And somehow didn't overstuff it.
Right. It is a truly great juggling act, and he did it very well. So that's my final thoughts.
I think you hit on something very important, which is that it's the first scary episode of Doctor Who, like, of this era, and it's also the most hopeful. Mm-hmm. And it's the scariest, and it also has the lowest body count, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's the most terrifying, and also everyone lives, and how I think that's part of why it's such a great relief at the end. and like why the end is so satisfying the way that it is. I don't have a whole much more to add because I think, yeah, this is a really good episode. I will say, just to say it, that I don't begrudge anyone their like ace representation. Like, I totally understand like having an ace experience and being like, oh, this is an important character, and it's kind of a bummer for there to be like sex in Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Even that being said, though, like, that doesn't change the, like...
I mean, he's mostly metaphorically fucking.
Yeah.
Can I say something as an A-spec person? Because there's a lot of misunderstanding about what it even is to be ace. And the thing is, like, it's a spectrum. Like, a lot of... Like, I know it has A in it, which seems to suggest that it's a is or isn't binary. But it's a little more complicated than that because, like, it's at the center of the concept of being asexual is the question of attraction, not sex.
Yeah.
So, like, people can be asexual and have sex. People can be asexual and have lots of sex, even be hypersexual. Like, it is entirely possible. But what an asexual person typically isn't is attracted to people, which you don't really have to be in order to have or even enjoy sex. Just saying, like, the fact that the Doctor was a grandfather at one point, to me, doesn't necessarily mean that the Doctor isn't ace. The fact that the Doctor seems to, like, fall in love with Rose over time, not spoiler alert for people who haven't seen the rest of these seasons, like, that doesn't change either the fact that the Doctor could be asexual, because, like, that doesn't happen immediately. It's not like it's the Doctor sees Rose and is like, wow, what a hottie. Like, that's not what happens.
Right. Right.
They get to know each other and they bond. And that's something that can happen, is people can bond and people can form a relationship that turns from one thing into one and into another without necessarily being attraction in the strictest sense. So, yeah, just wanted to throw that out there from an ace perspective. It's a complicated thing.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, and where on the spectrum do you hit a Dalek with a baseball bat?
I think that can be anywhere on the spectrum, really. That's more on the political spectrum, and that's, I would say, on the reasonable end.
Yeah, I know there was some discussion around it.
Because people didn't want the Doctor to fuck.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, coming from their own... There are many different ways to be ace, and I think when you kind of have somebody who where you're like, ah, this person matches my specific experience, and then it's a show that goes on for a long time and it's like, oh no, it's a little bit different, and then you are like, well, now it's not as fun for me. Like, I feel like there's definitely some of like those responses, or even, you know, Arrow people who are aromantic, who like didn't want to see, you know, the Doctor and Rose at all, because it's like, oh, there was a character who was aromantic and now there's not. I don't know. I didn't want to leave that unsaid as far as like this being a conversation about how the Doctor works and interacts with like relationships. Mm. And that there's other things outside of shame that would lead a person to not be involved with those things. And not to say that like, oh, well, this episode should have touched on this or whatever. Just not to leave it unsaid. That if like you watch the episode and you were like, I actually thought it was like a bummer because I'm aromantic, or you, and like that, like without saying it, it could be seen as like equivocating that with shame.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. It's different. That's all.
Yeah. I will say I'd rather see the Doctor being sexual than, you know, choking his companion. That.
Well, that's the same well, for yeah. some people. Mm.
Going back to that spectrum thing.
But yeah, I think that's everybody's final thoughts.
Yeah.
Before we go, is there anything we need to plug? Adam, what would you like to plug?
Like I said, I would like to plug The Real McCoy and Harry Sullivan is an Imbecile. You can find us on Twitter, but honestly, why would you be on Twitter anymore? It's terrible.
It's X now?
Yeah, no, I'm never calling it X, because that's like, no, that's so rubbish. But yeah, if you go into your podcast platform of choice and enter them in, you can find us. We're neither the most regular releasing, but hopefully we'll have new episodes out soon rather than later. You can also find me on Twitter, but again, don't. You can find me on Blue Sky as well. And yeah, that's it for me for pluggables.
Nice. Vince.
I haven't put anything out since last time I was on because I've died inside. And I'm no longer making art. No, I'm at some point I'm gonna get back to it. It's just I'm dead inside. Capitalism. So yeah, I guess I'm gonna plug. Give me money at just randomly. If you're listening and you have a lot of money, just give me some money. You can go on my Bandcamp and like pick a random song and just pay way too much for it, and then maybe I can quit my job and maybe I can get back to making art and I maybe can be not dead inside. So that's my plug.
Can I steal your plug?
Sure. Do you have a Bandcamp with a bunch of songs that people can pay what they want for?
No, but I do have a store and a like a place you can send me money.
We do have a Patreon.
A Patreon that is $11 away from our first stretch goal.
People should back your Patreon for way too much money. People who have too much money should give you too much money.
Yeah.
More than it's worth, they should give you.
I mean, it's worth a lot. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but they should give you more than that. Like, they should calculate how much they think it's worth, and then they should give, like, overpay. If they have too much money, they might as well.
Everyone should send their excess money to me or Vince. What was your Bandcamp? I interrupted you before you could drop the link.
It's vincentel.bandcamp.com. There I've got some old songs, and there's gonna be new stuff some point when I have the energy to record them. Because I've written stuff, I just haven't recorded it.
You can send money to me, and then I will send some of that to Vince if you buy The Princess and the Pterodactyls on my website, minipineapple.com/store.
Yeah, do that. It's a very silly book that we co-wrote with Ray Friesen.
Yeah, I will send some money to Ray as well, so.
But not as much.
No, it would be equal. It would be an equal amount.
No, I steal out of Ray's cut every time.
You do?
I do.
Oh, wow. That's my plug, minipineapple.com/store, and also our Patreon. Actually, you plug our Patreon.
I plug our Patreon?
Yeah, I plug my website, you plug the Patreon.
I wasn't prepared to plug the Patreon.
Plug it.
We have a Patreon.
And again, we're only $11 away from our first stretch goal.
Which is?
Guaranteed monthly bonus episodes, which you can get for $3 a month. On our Patreon. $100 a month, we do a guaranteed monthly bonus episode. At $150 a month, we will do Walk With Me. We'll release a new episode monthly, and it will go publicly. It's not behind a paywall.
It will not be behind a paywall. So if you get us to that stretch goal, you get it for your friends, too.
Mm-hmm. And I will take a day off of work a month to work on it. So
that's what the stretch goal is.
Is the amount I can afford to take a day off from work a month. So yeah, go to our Patreon, patreon.com/watchathon. And if you liked this episode of the podcast, you can check out more on watchyourasslon.com. You can also find our podcast, our Patreon, and more at linktree/watchathon. And want to say a special thanks to Vince for providing us with our theme song.
Thank you, Vince.
You're welcome.
Vince already said it, but go to vincentel.bandcamp.com to hear more of their music. And tune in.
To buy it for more than it's worth.
For more than it's worth. I don't know how you can get Adam money, but send Adam money too.
Please do. Please, please do. We're hopefully buying our own house soon, so please send me money.
But tune in next time when we talk about Boomtown. But until next time, keep calm and wrestle on.
Goodbye, and I love you in a platonic, parasocial way.
Have a tasteful tuna.
Bye-bye.
Everybody lives, Rose. Just this once. Everybody lives!
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.